Welcome to the 19th episode of the 6th season of the Ubuntu podcast. It's Wednesday the 3rd of July, and in this episode we're going to discuss what's been in the news. We'll also talk about the latest happenings in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on our website and in the IRC channel. I'm Laura, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello.
Tony.
Good evening.
And Mark.
Hiya!
There's always one.
So annoying.
Yeah.
So how are we this evening?
Tickety-boo.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's been a nice day, reasonably good weather.
My sunburn's recovered.
Excellent.
Ah, yes. So it has.
It's less of a glow.
I nearly didn't recognise you when you came in the house, but fortunately I did.
Good. Anyhow, let's get on with the show.
Time for the news when Tony fades me up. Our first news item.
You were the one busy clanking crockery around.
I was turning the clock over. Oh dear. Microsoft have backpedaled on their Xbox One DRM following customer backlash.
Yes, lots of people on the internet were annoyed.
Yes, people were angry.
Uncharacteristically.
Yes. So they launched this new console and loads of rumours flew about, and then it was confirmed that the console would not allow you to play used games.
Yeah, so you couldn't buy a game on disc and then sell it to someone else, basically,
yes.
Because it would say, no, this disc has already been played on another console.
And you wouldn't be able to play the console if you were completely offline. It would have to check in with phone home, like, periodically. They said something like once every 24 hours.
Mm.
And the internet went nuts.
Yeah.
Completely bonkers. Especially, you know, gamers who have already bought into, you know, a console and, you know, are looking to the next console to buy. And they make a commitment, a lot of them, either one console or another. And it's these kind of decisions that help sway their decision-making process.
Because consoles last for a long time, don't they?
Well, they can do. And some people, like, keep their consoles around and replay. Especially if you then have kids. Like, I'm digging out old games and playing them with my kids.
Hmm.
And if they make it so that I have to stay online and I'm reliant on some server somewhere that, you know, I can't necessarily connect to anymore. And other people, you know, they play their games in totally disconnected environments. And the scenario that was thrown at one of the Microsoft guys was, what about our military personnel in a submarine?
It's a very good point.
Yeah. Or military out posted in, like, foreign lands where they don't have a very reliable connection.
Yeah.
You know, it's... But anyway, they've reneged on this and backed down and said, okay,
excellent.
You can play...
They did it for our boys.
Yes. Well, their boys.
Yes, some boys. In other news, Richard Stallman has been inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame. I didn't know that the Internet Hall of Fame was a thing.
No, it seems it's been going since last year.
It makes me think of the...
the Internet Hall of Obscurity.
What's that TV show with Bender?
Futurama,
with all the heads in jars. Yes.
Well, I think Richard Stallman is hanging on to his for now. But his entry falls under the innovators category, along with the creator of Mosaic, one of the first web browsers, one of the Electronic Frontier Foundation co-founders, and Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia. He's the sad man who appears in the banner at the top sometimes on Wikipedia.
The man looking sad as opposed to the sad man.
Yes.
Well, yeah, potato, potato.
I can kind of see why Richard Stallman has been inducted into the Hall of Fame. I'm kind of surprised that it was him and not Linus.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, Richard is the spiritual leader of free software, I guess.
Yeah.
He's not the obvious creator, though, is he?
No, well...
Not anymore, that's the thing. I mean, back in the day...
He did Emacs.
Fair enough, but these days he just shouts.
And interestingly... The innovation, he didn't create something new. He did. Mm. He created the free software, but it was a continuation of the way the software had always been for him.
Mm.
So he helped create a license to preserve the way rather than saying we should do it this way around and give it all away.
Yeah.
But whereas Linus obviously was key in inventing the Linux kernel.
Well,
but, you know,
and arguably he was trying to simulate Minix on his or Unix environment on his home computer. So there's nothing new.
He innovated by giving it away.
Nothing's ever new.
Nothing's ever new, yeah.
Nothing at all.
I'm kind of curious if there's an innovators category, what the other categories are on the Internet Hall of Fame. Trolls, porn stars, you know, meaningless Tumblr accounts. What's the
podcasts?
Don't get your hopes up, Tony, on any of those categories.
Moving swiftly on, Google Plus Hangouts now features remote desktop support.
Ooh! Yeah. So you can steal control of someone else's computer via Google Hangouts.
With their consent.
Oh, of course.
And if they have the plugin installed, and if you do as well.
Okay.
And it all works and the planets are aligned?
I think it's pretty good. Can you get the plugin for Linux?
Hangout is pretty good, actually. It works quite well.
Yeah, so basically for Hangouts, we use Hangouts at work a lot, and it allows you to have like a multi-person video chat.
Yeah. Which is like doesn't unless you pay.
Right. Mm. And it's all free once you've signed your soul away to Google for a Google account. But they've added this feature that lets you request access to the other person's screen. Now, they've already got screen sharing where you can say, I would like to share my screen with everyone else on the call.
So they can see what you're doing.
Yeah, so if you want to present something or demo something, and we use that quite a lot. But this is the other way around. You're requesting access to control someone else's machine, and they have to accept, and then, you know, just like, you know, TeamViewer or VNC or something like that. But the reason I thought this was noteworthy is because it works on Windows, Mac, and Linux, it means that you can very easily support another member of the family. All they've got to do is just go to, you know, the Google Plus thing and join you in a Hangout, and you're done. It's pretty cool.
Cool.
I should have to try one of these Hangouts one day.
Yes. Join us in the 21st century, Tony.
Everyone's favourite tax dodgers, Amazon, have brought their auto-rip service to the UK.
This is pretty cool.
So this means that if you've ever bought a CD from Amazon of the 350,000, which is supported by the service, then you can go, yes, I'd like that in MP3 as well, and download it all, and you don't have to pay again.
Mm. Even if you bought it as a gift for somebody else?
I believe so.
So... all you do is log into Amazon and click the auto rip button, and then you accept the terms and conditions, and then it does a scanning thing and sits there for a while, and then says, "Ha ha! I found all this music that you've bought in the past." I did it on my Amazon account, and
lots of Black Lace. Was
it? Yeah, we'll get a lot of Cliff Richard.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that. Actually, it found one CD, which I bought as a present for someone else. And it was 29 tracks, and that was it. And that's the only thing it found. So I clearly don't buy music from Amazon.
29 tracks is a fair number.
29 singles. Oh, no, it was a double. It was a double CD thing.
Double album.
Yeah.
Now 83.
But yeah, it was a present for someone else. So it's not even something I would have bought.
Mm. It'd be really cool to have this for books. If you bought a book and you also got the e-book.
Yeah.
That would be really cool.
That would be really good.
You get this from Big Finish, don't you?
Yes, I bought a couple of books from Big Finish recently, and I got an ebook version with them.
Oh, that's cool.
In my Big Finish account, having bought the physical copy.
Yeah.
Because you get that for the audio books anyway, don't you?
If you buy the CD, you get a download version.
So. But that's when you buy, like, that's going forward. This,
yes.
The auto-rip is a retrospective thing that they've done.
Yes, I looked at it on mine, and I had an album from 2000 or something that I bought in 2000, which was Travis.
Right. Was that a present for someone else?
No, I think it's actually mine, although I couldn't lay my hands on it. Oh. Hey, it was
Tony
a sad
music
period
from, time. From after 1940. Well done. In graphics stack news, yes, it's been announced the plans for the graphics stack in Ubuntu for 1310 and 1404 and beyond, including Mir, Xmir, and Unity 7, 8, and so on.
So Xmir is the thing we mentioned before, which is going to let you run existing X Windows apps on the new Mir compositor.
Yes.
Right.
And so Ollie who works for Canonical, posted a blog post and sent a mail to the Ubuntu Devil mailing list, mm-hmm. Inviting discussion, but also to say these are our plans. This is what we're thinking. Cool. So,
and there's been some posts about getting the various flavors of Ubuntu, like Lubuntu and Xubuntu, running on Xmir as well.
Yeah. So Ollie's post is about what we're doing in Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And obviously, the flavors get to make their own decisions about what they do, because you know, they choose what desktop they want, they choose what apps they want. Some of the bits underneath that, they're kind of reliant on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
But you know, they generally make their own decisions, and they've been vocal in making their decisions.
Kubuntu in particular have said they are not going to use Xmir.
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing actually, because Riddell posted his. We spoke to all the leads of those projects and gave them a heads up to say, look, these are our plans. This is what we're going to do for the next year, so that you know what's going to happen. And Jonathan from Kubuntu posted his blog post late at night before Ollie had publicly announced that this is what we're going to do. And he posts his blog post saying Kubuntu's not switching to Mir. Which kind of was a bit daft, I think. But you know, they wanted to announce it. They wanted to be clear to their users and upstream what they were doing.
So, Mir, to ordinary people who were just using it, what difference will they see?
Eventually, none.
Well,
I thought you were going to say eventually loads.
Well, no, it's a plumbing thing. It's
that's what I was wondering.
It's like when the world's shifted from x386 to xorg. Mm. You know,
but there should be some differences, like, you know, smoother transition from boot to desktop, I would hope.
One of the things that they will notice, is in theory, from, you know, switching it on, you don't get a flicker between changing screen modes,
mm-hmm.
but that's, you know, from a day-to-day point of view, that's not like a dramatic, not like there's going to be suddenly something dramatically that changes in Mir. So no, it's mostly about the future and moving away from X.
So it won't be as dramatic as getting things like wobbly windows and
no. It's worth a read, though. There's an awful lot of posts on it. There's Pharonix have already done some benchmarks on it, and Ollie's written a couple of blog posts about benchmarking. We've been doing benchmarking as well internally, so you know we're aware of the performance issue that Pharonix brought up. So it's good.
Cool. A security researcher at Carnegie Mellon University, which I believe is a real university, has reported 1,200 crashes, that's 1,200 in decimal, in Debian Wheezy binaries.
What, in one day?
He used a tool to generate these crashes. You can't crash Debian that quickly.
It wasn't like Firefox just crashing repeatedly on him 1,200 times.
No, this was different packages. He tested, I think, something like 23,000 packages, and in that he got 1,200 reports.
2,300 packages, and he got.
So he got lots of crashes.
Lots of crashes
to report them.
Yes. So he emailed the one of the Debian lists and said, "I've got a lot of reports to file, but I don't want to just throw them all at you at once. What's the best thing to do?"
That's a really nice thing to do, isn't it?
Yes.
Awesome. What did they say? Take them and shove them.
Thanks very much. We really appreciate you not just throwing us 1,200 bugs or 1,200 bugs or whatever you want to call it.
Pipe them to Dev Null.
Yeah. But it's an interesting read, and it's a good way to show that, you know, people are contributing to Debian, and that benefit will be seen by, you know, lots of other people. Ubuntu, you know, Mint and loads of other, and no doubt that will all go upstream as well. So, you know, everyone wins.
Brilliant.
Cool. Hardware.info have been testing a pair of Samsung SSDs to destruction because they're guaranteed for 1,000 read-write cycles across the whole device, but the test showed them to survive 3 times that long.
Yeah, I think they've got some new chip that they've got in which they wanted to test to see if they were any better or worse than the previous technology. And they found, they ran a test for 2 months, basically just constantly writing and writing and writing and writing to these disks. And the first drive, the second drive they said is still running, and the first drive failed. It started to show that it was failing after they wrote 707 terabytes of data and failed after 888 terabytes of data. had been written to it.
I should have put like a webcam on it and put it on.
Did. Yes.
Oh, did they?
It was live streamed.
Oh, was it? They live streamed it.
Yeah.
See, I just know these things too well.
But the thing that I found interesting about this was because people are often reluctant to get an SSD because there's this long-held belief that SSDs are unreliable and they'll all fail and you lose all your data. It's hardware, it can fail. But they were just trying to show, at least in part, that it's possible for these things to actually last longer than the manufacturer says the life cycle of the thing is. It's a phenomenal amount of data they threw at these discs. Yeah.
And one interesting thing they found out was that the wear leveling algorithm, which is supposed to move data between the different physical bits of the disc so that one bit doesn't get worn down by being rewritten, it also applies if you just leave some data on the disc, then it will still move it around as other things get rewritten so that you don't end up with one really good part of the disc which has had the same data on it forever and other bits getting really worn out. It still applies across, which is one of the ways it keeps it going.
So if you're watching them on a webcam, what do they do?
Flash.
Because when I was imagining that, I was thinking of them going... Because they won't, because they're SSDs, and they're not going to float the Imperial theme or anything.
Yeah. Or burst into flames in a spectacular fashion.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
Douglas Engelbart died last night. We are sorry to announce, but who was he?
He invented the computer mouse.
Oh.
A whole bunch of human-computer interaction stuff. And apparently, I'm quoting this from the article, his research and efforts led to the development of a diverse set of technologies such as hypertext, networked computers, and the graphical user interface.
Well, well.
I vaguely think he wrote an article for me.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. I might be lying.
Which
maybe
came
somebody
first,
wrote an article
the pointer
on
or
him.
The mouse?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good existential question, which we haven't got time to answer this evening.
It was a block of wood.
Okay.
But, a big contribution to computing, sir. Well done, Douglas.
Yes.
And our final news, something that Tony will be very excited about.
I'm all ears.
Google, it's a rumour that Google are developing an Android-based games console.
Fantastic.
So as our resident games reporter, we would like to get your opinion.
And how that will affect the Ouya and the GameStick and other popular
and do you think
consoles.
Apple might be coming along with their answer to the... small factor games console soon?
I think it will affect all of those things.
And how do you think it will change your life?
It would have changed my life if they could invent a games console that played the games itself so I didn't have to bother. That would be ideal.
Except the Simpsons.
How much of the time do you spend on that Simpsons game?
Not all of the time.
Surprising amount for somebody who doesn't play games.
Yeah, it's not a game, it's just control over people. Excellent. Right, a quick comment from Red Tape Renegade, who's listening to the live stream in our IRC channel. He says he loves Hangouts. He talked to an Ubuntu developer on one, and he's a complete idiot.
Hang on. Which one? Ubuntu developer.
He is a complete idiot, not the
developer.
Ubuntu developer.
Right.
But those are his own words, so he can't sue me. And that's the end of the news.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If there's something you think we should talk about or someone we should talk to, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content. And that can only mean one thing, more quizzes.
It's time for our Ubuntu community news now, and Alexander Hanf posted to the Ubuntu Devel discuss list, proposing a change to Ubuntu's default search engine.
Oh, did he propose we change it to Bing?
DuckDuckGo.
No, it wasn't DuckDuckGo. It was...
Yahoo?
No. Nope.
Start page.
What?
Who?
Which is a... in the same way that DuckDuckGo is a sort of privacy-enhanced front for Bing, Start page is a privacy enhanced front for Google.
How do they enhance my privacy?
By I think they don't track your searches through the site, and therefore Google knows it's them that's forwarding the search, but they don't know who the search is coming from, so they're not tracking your search. And I think they also have the option for more privacy, like they'll do a proxy connection from them through to Google as well in some cases.
Okay, and so Alexander proposed that in order to enhance the privacy of our user base, that we should change the default search engine from Google to Startpage for all our users.
Partly why Startpage in particular, not DuckDuckGo, who are also quite popular, is that Startpage is based in the Netherlands, whereas DuckDuckGo is based in the US. So,
And we've seen that the US has no influence whatsoever over European countries after seeing the Bolivian Prime Minister diverted after two countries shut their airspace this week.
It's his concern is that even though DuckDuckGo says they don't track you, they may still be compelled by US legislation to collect data about you and not say they collect data about you, whereas the laws in the Netherlands aren't quite as bad.
So what did the other devils say?
It kind of went a bit quiet. It didn't. I thought it would get a fair bit of conversation going about the pros and cons, but actually the thread kind of died.
There's a financial implication, isn't there? Chronicle get a kickback from Google for having that as a default search engine?
Yes.
But presumably they wouldn't do any alternative.
I don't know what the financial side of Startpage is. I don't know whether they get revenue for pushing people towards Google and therefore they can pass that on to customers. I don't know. But the thread kind of died a death, so it's a bit of a shame.
Fair enough.
A Juju charm competition has been launched, offering $10,000 for the most innovative charm.
That's charming.
Okay, thanks for that input.
He's here all week.
A quick recap, what's a charm?
So Juju is like apt-get for the cloud.
We've spoken to George Castro before about Juju.
And so you could Juju deploy some amazing cloud application that you use to run your business or whatever using Juju and scale out to hundreds of nodes if you wanted to.
This is on Ubuntu cloud.
Yeah, on a cloud. It could be and running Ubuntu, or it could potentially be running something else. And charms are like the packages that you install. So you could have a charm for Hadoop or a charm for WordPress and a charm for MySQL.
And so you can read app.
Yes. Yes. Effectively, but you can make kind of more complex charms that pull in lots of different apps, and so the competition is to try and motivate people to create charms which are complicated, innovative, you know, clever in some way, and enable cloud deployments of, you know, some funky application, whatever it may be. Cool. Details on the website.
Brilliant.
Mark Shuttleworth has blogged about the Carrier Advisory Group. Who are they then?
So it's a group chaired by an independent person, and it's a bunch of carriers from around the world.
These mobile phone network
operator carriers, yes. And they get together on a regular basis with Canonical and talk about Ubuntu Phone.
So this is a way of making sure that when Ubuntu Touch is ready to ship on a phone, that it's in a state which is actually of interest to the people who are going to be putting the packages together.
Yeah. So over the last like 6 months, Mark Shuttleworth has been traveling around to all parts of the world talking to carriers, and he's been having meetings with them, and they've been giving us a lot of input about, you know, things we should do before they would consider deploying an Ubuntu phone.
Yeah.
And rather than have lots of those individual conversations all around the place, he thought it would be a good idea to have an advisory group, a panel, representing those who have an interest in putting Ubuntu on a phone. And they get a benefit in that they get exclusivity if they join the carrier advisory group. And over the last couple of weeks, Mark's been blogging about and mentioning on Google+ and Facebook and Twitter and other places that various carriers have joined the advisory group from all around the world. Which is cool.
And lots of, literally it is a global thing. Mm. There's people from all sorts of countries popping up.
Yeah, I think today another one joined from Indonesia. So it's like, you know. Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed is people tend to be very interested in the carriers where they live, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I want Orange, Vodafone, you know, T-Mobile or whatever, and people in the US want Sprint, Verizon, and so everyone's championing their own networks, but really it needs just a core set of very dedicated carriers wherever they are in the world to deploy this so that we can get the first version out and, you know, move on from there. I don't think it would the carrier advisory group doesn't need to have every network in every country. That's not the point of it. Just a few dedicated carriers. Mm. That's what they've got.
Excellent.
Oh, it's my turn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought I'd finished speaking. Never.
It's such hard work when you're not here.
We also have a blog post from Victor Palau, who's written about achieving differentiation on Ubuntu Touch. So related to that, about how we differentiate, how carriers can differentiate what they deliver.
So how they can stick in their own horrible apps, which are you immediately trying to
Well, that's exactly what it's about. That's exactly what the blog post talks about. Is the worst thing about carriers is the fact that they all slap their horrible stuff on top of Android at the moment.
Yeah,
and you know it leads to this horrid fragmentation and
So it's how to give them something attractive while not screwing over the users by giving them a bad experience.
Exactly. And it talks about how we can build it from the start with that differentiation and customization built in.
Right. Brill. Ollie Rees has blogged about the first independent benchmarks for Mir, the exciting graphics stack that we talked about earlier in the show. They've been published by Phoronix, who do a lot of benchmarks.
Mm. Yes.
And what have we learned from the benchmarks?
I think some of the performance showed like a 10% degradation or thereabouts.
Compared to running on X?
Running on standard X, yeah.
That's
right
probably
now.
What you'd expect, isn't it?
Well, for something that we've just put out. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, and there was a hangout yesterday, I think it was, where Ollie and a whole bunch of engineers were taking questions from interested parties. And they were talking about, you know, whether we can get that performance loss, you know, down to zero and whether it can be exactly the same. And one of the interesting points that Chris House Rogers, who's one of our engineers, said was what's interesting to note is when you're doing benchmarks, if you're benchmarking something like OpenGL performance, that's not actually what most people use their computer for, their desktop. Mm. Raw OpenGL frame rate is not vital for paging down in a document and opening applications and moving windows around.
Mm-hmm.
It's a factor, but the average user wouldn't notice that 10% degradation is what they're asserting.
Okay.
Obviously, they want to try and get that down, so it's not 10%. It's like lower than that, but it's not as bad as it's necessarily painted.
Mm. Fair enough.
And finally,
in Not About Ubuntu, Fedora 19 is out.
Ooh, excellent. Well done, the Fedora project.
Schrodinger's cat.
Ah,
what about it?
That's the code name for Fedora 19.
Do we know what Fedora 20 is called yet?
I don't know, actually.
More on that next week.
Hopefully, yes. Well, Fedora 19 has GNOME version 3.8. Some new applications, such as a clock, it says in the release.
It's all very exciting.
Is it turning into KDE?
Has it got another calculator?
Yes, to all of the above. You can have classic mode, and there's also a mate environment, so you can run old version of GNOME that doesn't work anymore.
So there's two old versions of GNOME?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has all of the old versions of GNOME in.
Wow.
In any possible combination.
Good.
And KDE Plasma Workspaces 4.10.
Right.
But there are some events that we're going to tell you about.
Yes, we are.
They're coming up now.
There's an augmented reality for Android with OpenStreetMap event. It's a BCS event happening at Southampton Solent University on a date, which I'm about to tell you.
What date would that be then, Mark?
Well, you know, the thing about dates is there's so many of them, it can be hard to fill in the time
until you've got it on your screen.
I think it's on the... It's the 4th of July, which is tomorrow at 6 p.m.
Excellent.
Well done, us.
Yeah.
Yeah, cracking bit of planning there.
No, we're really smooth, aren't we? The next one's even better because it's just a URL and has no details
at all. It's called Campus Party, and I was loading the page while we spoke.
And not half an hour ago.
And it doesn't say
when
it is.
We'll have a link in the show notes.
It's probably last week.
Okay, good. The next event we do know all about because it's one of my events.
Oh, good.
Open Source Junction 5, which is looking at open source in the public sector, is happening at the University Club in Oxford on the 18th and 19th of this month. So that's in just a couple of weeks. Basically, we're going to get together a bunch of people who are interested in finding out more about open source in the public sector and what solutions are available and where you can get them from and who's been doing things and what you can learn from them. So if you work in IT in the public sector and you want to know more about open source, it's free for public sector people and you can sign up at osj5.eventbrite.co.uk.
I think that makes up for the two that we knew nothing about. Finally, there's OgCamp.
Yay!
The country's premier open source and...
slash only.
Techie event.
Should get...
Well, we don't know anything about that either yet.
The 19th and 20th of October at Liverpool John Moores University in Liverpool. And we're looking for people to sign up to join the crew. We'll put a link to the form in the show notes if you're interested in helping out.
The crew are basically the people who make OgCamp happen. We just sort of get some people in the building, but they're the real stars of the show.
We don't really even do that. We sit and talk about OgCamp every 2 weeks on the podcast and then turn up.
So if you're in
some of us do anyway. Well,
so if you would like to help out, you don't need to have any particular skills. If you've got a pair of hands that can carry boxes around, that's useful. But if you have got AV skills or something like that, that's also useful to know about.
Or if you've just got a lot of enthusiasm.
Yep. We'd love to hear from you and send you over to Big Les Pounder and he will point you in the right direction.
And give you a free T-shirt. And that's all for this episode. Join us next time when we'll be interviewing Barney Brown from Intercontinental Music Lab, reading your feedback and making your life a little bit easier with some command line norographical love.
Ha ha! You'll have to wait and see till next week.
Oh dear. A whole week to work out whether that's a good answer to that question or not.
Yeah.
Spoiler, it's command line love.
Oh, I won't be bothered. I won't bother coming next week then. Oh well, maybe I will. Find out next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.